lot of work goes into every marine band performance. The 60-plus musicians on stage put a lot of time and effort into their music making, but there's another group of people behind the scenes working even harder. And without them, most of you wouldn't have the chance to hear us perform. I'm talking, of course, about our incredible recording lab team. Thank you for joining us today, wherever you may be listening. We have quite the panel for you today. First off, we have our assistant chief of the recording lab, Staff Sergeant Ophir Paz. Hello, Ophir.
Hi, good to be here.
Next, our chief of the recording lab, Gunnery Sergeant Michael Dukasu. Thank you for joining us, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
And then finally, we have our lone instrumentalist, our principal euphonium, Master Gunnery Sergeant Mark Jenkins. How are you, Mark?
Good, Connor. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thank you all for joining me, and we'll get into it. I know all of us here at the Marine Band are extremely thankful and proud of our recording lab, but for a typical concert goer, you might not be as familiar as what the recording lab does. You might not be as familiar with that as you are with the instruments on stage. So in very general terms, what is it that you do here at the Marine Band?
Sure. So the recording lab is actually kind of split into two worlds, especially nowadays. We have audio professionals as well as video professionals, and we go out to every concert and support it on either an audio or a video standpoint. So let's say we're out in the public doing a concert band, just open concert, playing a bunch of stuff, and that particular one, we want to document it in, you know, either an audio or a video way. The folks from the recording lab will be out there to help assist with those types of things. But in addition to the recording side, you keep hearing the term recording, we also do live sound reinforcement as well. So there's actually, on one particular concert, we might have three particular humans doing different things in order to support that concert from a live sound point, a recorded sound point, and a video sound point.
Right, and we only have what, maybe one, maybe two performances a week that we need you guys for, right?
Yes, it definitely stays busy.
That was a joke in case anyone listening didn't quite catch that. They are very, very busy all the time.
Yes. So in addition to supporting the stuff that we do for live concerts, Ophir, maybe you can talk more about some of the recorded stuff we do outside of the concert realm.
Sure. So we do record quite a bit. We do have the annual album, which consists of usually the band. We end up recording multiple pieces for the album, which gets released usually around December every year. And in the past few albums, we've done double albums. Other than that, we also record small projects for releases, such as produced videos, produced audio.
So double album, also known as basically just two albums, right?
Yes, there is quite a bit of music.
Right. So, Mark, I think that even you and I as performing members of the band don't always catch all of the work that the lab does for us. What are some of the things that you're most impressed by as an instrumentalist from our side of things?
Well, there's a lot. I remember when I was thinking about this question, I thought about the first time I heard the Marine Band recorded. It was in 1994. I was in high school. I just dated myself.
I was two.
Okay,
so.
Thank you, Connor. Thank you for bringing that up. I was at my friend's house, and we were listening to his dad's record collection, and he had a cassette tape of the Marine Band. It was our first overtures recording that we did in the 80s with Colonel Bourgeois. And the first track on that was that really great arrangement of Dvorak's Carnival Overture that we've played on tour a few times. And he pushed play on that thing, and the sound that came out of that recording was just, I think all musicians have had that experience in our lives, you know, that recording or those recordings that just make us just absolutely marvel at music and recorded sound. And this was one of those takes. And ever since I've gotten to this place, it's been over 20 years since I've been in the Marine Band, I've just always been so impressed at the level of sound that we can get out of these recordings. And it's not just in a studio with all of the controlled circumstances and the controlled environment. Like Mike said, it's outdoors, it's in hot, it's in cold. I mean, the recording of the inauguration, for example, is a marvel that it sounds that good. one of the things that we did a few years ago was, I think we did a, it was an education conference up in Baltimore, and we were in some convention center ballroom, and there was zero reverb in that room, and the whole band was set up, and we played a really hard program, and I'm thinking to myself, how is this ever going to sound decent? And I listened to the recording, and it sounded like we're in Carnegie Hall or something. I mean, the amount of work that it takes to put that level of sound in a recording is unbelievable. And it's not just the recording process. The recording crew is there before anyone else gets there. It takes hours to put up the mics, to put up the systems. Then they do the recording session, and then we all leave and get to go home. And they have to stay back and tear it all down. And when we're on tour, they have to do it again the next night and the next night while, you know, driving a car from town to town.
And they actually set up the podcast rig that we are talking on right now. They set it up and sat down to be interviewed.
So they're often the unsung heroes. But again, without them, there really wouldn't be a United States Marine Band because no one would hear us outside the D.C. area. So it's a tremendous job, and I'm very, very grateful for Mike and all the crew that he has. So, great job, guys.
So, Mark, you mentioned the Marine Band sound, and I think it's pretty apparent for anyone who listens to even just recordings of us that we kind of present this iconic Marine Band sound as it's sort of been labeled by others in the past. So, if any of you at home have been able to come to a live performance of ours, I don't think there's even too much of a difference between what's captured by the recording lab and what you hear live. Obviously, there's a difference with live performance, but you all capture that sound really well. But what is that sound? What is it that you look for to capture and get on the recording so that people can hear the true Marine Band?
Sure, that's it's an interesting question, and we get that one quite often. And it's a situation where we're not necessarily looking for a particular setup in every situation, because as Mark mentioned, when we're out on the road, when we're honestly even in town doing different venues, every place sounds different. But there is one constant, and that is the band in front of us. So no matter where we are, no matter what we are doing in the country or even across the world, the band is the constant. So we're very fortunate. The band, as you all know, is awesome. And we are really fortunate to be able to record them all the time. So we know one thing, the band is going to set up in a very particular way, and that allows us to deploy our resources in order to capture it. So we're always focused on what is the band playing that day and how can we get it to be consistent from recording to recording. And that's honestly a whole team effort to talk to the stage managers and say, hey, is your setup changing today? Hey, are we using horn shields today for our French horns? Hey, are these things getting deployed? Because then we know this is going to change the sound of our band, which is what we're inevitably trying to capture. So what is the Marine Band sound? It's the Marine Band. The musicians have a particular vibe, and we're just there to capture it, because they are the constant from, you know, the recording that Mark mentioned from a long time ago in the 90s. Sorry, it wasn't too long ago. all the way through to the stuff that we're recording today, the band is always the constant.
Right, and something interesting you mentioned. So do you adjust your strategy based on what repertoire is picked? There isn't just a standard setup. Here's the band recording setup. Do you change that based on the pieces?
So, you know, we actually do change it quite a bit, but we have our usual go-tos. We start off with our main array, which is consisting of multiple microphones at specific measurements, and we do end up changing the height of it, the distance, and the surrounding mics. One thing I want to note is, yes, we have the sound of the Marine Band, but we have so many different ensembles within this organization that we need to adjust our approach to every single group. And then another thing to consider is that we, as recording engineers, as audio people, as video people, especially in the live performance situation, we capture a moment in time that will never be repeated the same way. And so we need to be able to portray it to the listener the way that it was at that moment. One thing that stands out to me is that back last summer, we had a performance at Kennedy Center with the great John Williams. And he noted that one of his highlights of performing and conducting the Marine Band is the bass drum. The way the bass drum projects in any space. And really our job is to take that sound and make sure that it sounds as natural as possible to the listener, to the other end of that process.
I remember I was on that concert actually with Maestro Williams, and I remember him specifically mentioning, oh, I love this band's bass drum. I love how this band plays their bass drum. And I just thought that was so neat that he cued into that, and then you all pick up on that and translate that to a recording. Mm-hmm. So there's some element of sort of maybe improv when it comes to each individual piece and group.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of it is... it's a very scientific job. It is engineering after all, but it's also experience and adjusting basically to the last second, because we can look at a microphone array and know that this will work or this might need to get adjusted and fixed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to Ophir's point, you know, we have documentation from our predecessors of things that they've done through the years. And we've kind of taken that approach and say, okay, here's what we were doing, you know, in the early 2000s. Here's what we were doing in, you know, 2010. And, you know, while our technology is changing, you know, we are still honestly using some of those techniques today, but modified to the point that Ophir was just talking about. One other thing that Ophir alluded to is that we are recording a lot of different ensembles. In fact, just this past calendar year, we released our first ever orchestral album. And, you know, I think we will probably be doing some more of that stuff down the line. But our first commercial orchestral album didn't really have that data to pull from. Since it was the first commercial recording we've done for that ensemble, you know, we went into this space we've never recorded in. The band has done some work there, but this team of recording engineers hadn't worked there before. And, you know, we assessed the room and deployed some tools that we thought would get the product that the Colonel wanted at that time.
So speaking of all of this incredible knowledge, something that's unique to the Marine Band is just how specialized each of us are at our job. We have performing members that hold music degrees all the way to doctorates like Mark here, but that specialization stretches to every corner of the band. Mike and Ophir, what kind of training and experience did you have in recording technology before joining the band?
Sure. So my path is a little unusual. When I first got into music, sound was not something that I did. I went to college to become a music educator and a jazz performer. And while at Temple University studying those things, I was approached to get into live sound as part of my work study. And I never really thought it would turn into the path that it took me to today. But from there, I took every single recording class that Temple offered. From there, I went on to get a master's degree in audio engineering. It's a master of music in a music production track. And from there, I just started doing a bunch of production work. Started my own company where I was doing... live recordings at location events, much like we do with the Marine Band now. And yeah, so the path was a little bit, you know, started as a music teacher, started to do recording, and then saw a Marine Band post to become a recording engineer and said, didn't know that was a thing. And here we are talking today.
Yeah, so my journey actually started as most musicians at a very young age. And I think I started playing saxophone when I was around six. And that was just a lot of fun. You know, it was the musical experience, the way I could truly express who I am. And at that point, as time evolved, I started wanting to write music and capture it and just layer things, but there was no way to do that live. So I bought this $200 recording software package and started truly just putting things together. Never thought of recording to be something I wanted to go into. I just wanted to create. After that, after a long time, I did end up going to the Cleveland Institute of Music for recording, for audio recording. And there I... participated in the recording arts services, which we recorded for all the ensembles, all the chamber concerts, recitals. I did a lot of freelancing on the side. And Yeah, like Mike, I never thought the marine band would be an option. Never was in my preview. But once it was the goal. It was what I wanted. And here we are.
Wow, that's a lot of training. I think the extent of my recording knowledge is a couple of YouTube videos I watched a few years ago. Maybe that's about it. How to get the best sound out of your cell phone recording device. But Ophir, you alluded to this earlier. For me, the crown jewel of the recording lab, from my perspective, is the Marine Band's albums. And we put out about an album a year, not counting the extra projects and the double albums, and it always turns out fantastic. From our side as performers, it's already a lot of work, but even more so for the lab. You mentioned these albums release in December. Well, we record them in March.
Yes.
So what sort of challenges go into constructing an entire album of band music?
Well, when it comes to any of these projects, it's all about the planning. And right out of the gate, when we hear from the command, hey, this is going to be our album that we have coming up, the support staff kind of springs into action. The library starts making scores for everybody to preview the music that's going to be coming out on that album. We sit down with the command and say, okay, we now see the music, we're holding it. What kind of things are you hoping to get out of this recording? And in essence, the whole team starts to communicate about, here's what we want the end product to be. From there, the lab says, cool, we now know what everybody wants. Now we're going to figure out how to get that. And that's kind of a multi-pronged approach. So there's the whole tech side that we have to sort out, which is all the equipment that needs to be built in order to record. One thing that's really unique about the Marine Band is we actually go off-site to record all of our commercial recordings. Out in the world, there are many recording studios that people will go to, and everything is built into the studio. So the group rolls in, everyone patches in, and away you go. In our situation, we actually take the studio to a location. So because of that, it requires a bit more planning, a bit more research, and a lot more building of stuff. which is, our first great challenge. So once we design all the equipment, we get that sorted out. We go through and pick all the microphones and all that stuff for that particular thing. But then it's the on-site bit, which I mentioned earlier today, was a collaboration with the stage managers, figuring out where all this stuff's going to be on stage, because, we have one shot to record these things. But the nice thing about a studio setting, even at a location, is that we get multiple chances to record something in a really tight timeline. So that's the biggest challenge with our recording sessions is, hey, we have, the full ensemble on stage, we have the piece of music that we're trying to record, and we have just a few hours to do sometimes some really difficult material.
So who does the editing in the recording lab? So obviously, there's a little bit, we try to keep the live performance aspect of it as true as possible, but there is some editing that goes into these recordings. Who in the recording lab stitches that together and is the surgeon for these recordings?
Sure. Yes, the recording process is one thing. The editing process is a whole different monster.
Indeed.
So basically what we end up doing is we have producers on site who take notes and truly gather every single information about every single take and decide what's the best take to use for any given moment. Once that is being done, they give us the feedback and they give us a list of those takes. And the people who edit it is our four audio engineers. And we go into the studio and start gluing together the final product.
Yeah, and then once we ended up getting those final stitched pieces together, we'll take it into a process that we call mastering. In essence, we will get that final product and get it set to go out to the world. So mastering is kind of our last step where we apply any last bit of processing that we might want to do, but then we get it set to go to a streaming platform, go to a CD, wherever it is going, we will create a master that will go out to the world for that media.
Mark, speaking of recording sessions, from our side of the instrumentalist process, do you as a performer prepare or play any differently when we're on stage for this limited amount of time trying to get things in the can?
That's a good question. I don't think that I prepare any different when I'm preparing for a performance versus a recording session. I don't know about you, but I think that one thing that all professional musicians know when they walk into a recording studio is you know that before you leave there, you have to play it perfectly at least once, probably multiple times. And there's a pressure that goes with that. However, unlike a performance on stage, when you know you only have one shot, at least in a recording studio, you know that there's at least the option, probably the necessity of having multiple takes. So, you know, if you make a blip here or there, you have the option of doing it again, which is, it's a good feeling. But like I said, you do know that you're going to have to play it multiple times perfectly, probably before you leave. And that does create some pressure. And it's definitely on the minds of musicians when we're preparing to enter into recording studios. One thing that's helped me a lot in my career has been to record myself in my practicing. It's not something new and innovative, but it does help a lot, because what it does for me is it allows me in real time to hear what I sound like on tape in the comfort of my own home, and to see if there are technical problems with what I'm playing, if there are musical problems with what I'm playing, and I can instantly hear and adjust in real time. And also, and this might just be me, but whenever I push that little red button on my cell phone, even though I know I'm the only one in the room and I'm the only one that will ever hear that track, there's just a little bit of pressure that comes into, you know, your mind, like, we're recording this, okay? And even though it's just minimal, it still, I feel, conditions me as a performer to kind of accept that pressure that you feel when you walk into the recording studio. And that little red light next to the conductor's podium pops on. You're like, okay, this is business time. You know, here we go. But the recording aspect in my practice also allows me to develop my ear so that I can hear if there's changes that need to be made musically in the moment. So if we're in a recording session, this is also a really good thing about having multiple takes, is because when you're in a recording session and you've practiced a certain solo a certain way in a piece, and for whatever reason, in the context of that day and that music and that space, it just doesn't seem to work, you can change it. And you can talk with the conductor or maybe your colleagues in the band and maybe interpret it a different way in that moment. And then our great recording engineers will put that in the final recording, and it'll sound so much better than maybe if it was just a performance on stage and you had one shot at it. So I think the recording bit is definitely something that I do. But other than that, you just have to, you have to be on your game and, you know, and do your very best. But the recording sessions in the Marine Band have been some of my most favorite memories. They've been the moments where some of the greatest music that I've made in this ensemble have happened. So it's been a great experience.
I always find that I get a little more nervous at a recording session. I'm fortunate enough to not struggle with too much performance anxiety when it comes to being on a stage. But yeah, when that red light goes on, suddenly the comfort of the practice room dissolves from away around me, and I have to think about who I'm playing with, what I'm doing, and I'm maybe a little bit more aware of the rest of the ensemble in a recording session.
And I do want to add to what Mark was saying, is that as a recording engineer, I feel so fortunate that the Marine Band, the President's Own Marine Band, is one of the most consistent groups I have worked with, and I'm sure many people have worked with. Every single take that we do is almost militant.
Imagine
military
that.
Military precision.
Just timing, pitch, any sort of musicianship does follow from take to take, which is wonderful for our process.
Well, when you're ordered to play it well, you got to play it well. Nothing like that. Well, our listeners may not know this, but the Marine Band actually has a big part in the history of recording technology. We took part in some of the earliest forms of recording. Mark, what kind of recording did the Marine Band first take part in?
Well, the first medium that we were recorded on, believe it or not, was a cylinder made of wax. Well, it all starts with, of course, Thomas Edison, who patented his phonograph machine, I think in 1878, something like that. And at that time, his first material that he recorded on was a cylinder wrapped in that sort of a tinfoil material that registered vibrations from a a funnel or a horn that would go, that would channel the vibrations down to a little membrane that would excite the needle that would basically inscribe in this tinfoil material. And he tried to sell it. It didn't go very far. So he kind of put it on the back burner for just a little project that he was tackling. It's called the light bulb. he invented the light bulb, and then he went back to the phonograph. That's how successful he was.
Yeah, priorities.
Yeah, you know. And so after he, you know, changed the world with the light bulb, he decided to go back to the phonograph because he had some competition from a rival by the name of Alexander Graham Bell, who had, in the interim, figured out that recording on a wax cylinder was actually more precise than the little tinfoil thing that Thomas Edison had designed, you know, a decade earlier. So Edison rightly said, well, I've got to get into this business again. So he tried again to market it. But this time he sold licenses to people around the country to actually start up their own business and just sell his product wherever they were. So two former government clerks here in Washington, they quit their jobs and they bought, with their money, they bought a license from Thomas Edison to start their own company here. And they called it the Columbia Phonograph Company. And it was right up here on Pennsylvania Avenue, not too far from where we're sitting. And their marketing strategy was very simple. They wanted to market these machines, which Edison had originally thought they would be best as voice dictation machines. So instead of writing something down, you could just record your own voice, and then you'd have a cylinder, a record of it, that you could play back. So they thought that if they could get a government contract for these machines, they could make $1 million, and they could, you know, have them in every agency in Washington, D.C. And so if you had a memo or you had some sort of letter that needed to be transcribed, instead of bringing your secretary in and having to do it in shorthand and then transcribing it in longhand and then making copies, you could just make a couple of these cylinders and just pass them around and people could have the letter. Well, it didn't work like that, unfortunately. They didn't sell many machines, and so their company started to flounder, and they started to think, well, where else can this possibly work, this machine and the wax cylinders? And they actually found that amusement parks and arcades, penny arcades, use them as attractions. They would buy the machine, and they would get a local performer to record anything. They would record sounds. They would record someone reciting a poem or the Gettysburg Address or someone singing a song. And then they would charge a nickel or a penny for someone to listen to that wax cylinder. And so it became a real popular attraction. And they started going to the Columbia Phonograph Company and saying, hey, do you have any more of these cylinders? And so pretty quickly, these two guys realized, well, we're going to be making more money off the cylinders rather than the machines themselves. So they started producing their own wax cylinders, and they started getting local talent to do that. But they came and they ran into their first problem, and which was scale. They couldn't reproduce the wax cylinders. There was no process to make a copy, a carbon copy of a wax cylinder. So let's say you had a client come in and say, I want this guy reciting the Gettysburg Address. I want 10 copies of it. You'd have to get that person in a studio with one phonograph machine, and he'd have to recite it 10 times flawlessly to get the 10 copies. So you can see that that's a problem. Yeah. I mean, it's just not very practical. So then they said, well, let's try this. Let's get a bunch of phonograph machines and put it in one room and then have the one guy reciting the Gettysburg Address, and he just says it and all the machines pick it up. Well, that didn't work either, because the needles at the time were pretty stiff in engraving in the wax, and you had to have a lot of sound going into that horn to make them etch correctly on, am I getting this right?
Absolutely.
Etch correctly on the wax cylinder. And so they needed a large sound, and they needed multiple people in the room to make this large sound.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Enter the United States Marine Band, which actually, we were their neighbors. We were right down the street. So I think this was 1890, and the Columbia Phonograph Company approached the band director of the Marine Band, who happened to be John Philip Sousa, and they asked him if he would be interested in having the band record some of his most famous marches. So Washington Post March, the Thunderer March, Semper Fidelis, and all of these were pretty popular at the time. So it might have been a pretty lucrative idea for Sousa, but actually he was leery of it. He didn't, even after he left the Marine Band, all the to the point where he retired, he never respected the recording industry itself. He's the one that coined the term canned music, if you've ever heard that term. Mm. And actually, it's because the wax cylinders used to come in, they looked like cans. So he called it music in a can, canned music. And the reason he didn't like it is because, well, number one, let's be honest, the sound quality was really not great. I mean, you could hear there was sound in there. You'd maybe be able to hear that it was Washington Post March, but I mean, it didn't sound anything like the live Marine band.
Yeah, you can't hear the alto two part going on with a counter melody, right?
That's exactly what I was thinking, yes. So he didn't like it for that reason. And Sousa also was actually kind of leery of it because he had made a lot of money at that point with making sheet music of his marches. So if you loved the Washington Post March, you could go into the local music shop and you could buy a copy and go home and play it on your banjo or your piano or wherever. And he thought that if people had a record of it, they wouldn't buy his sheet music.
Hmm.
So he was kind of skeptical. But he signed the contract, and in the next 2 years, between 1890 and 1892, the band recorded over 230 tracks for Columbia Records.
Wow.
We have a lot of them, not all of them. Is it UC Santa Barbara that has their archive, Mike?
Yeah. Yeah, and we actually still have a lot of those cylinders in our archive, in our basement, in our library. So it's very cool to go hold one of these canned music vessels, but yeah, we had them all transferred and they're living in our archive,
and we have some of those digitized. And just because I'm curious as well, here's a little snippet of what those sounded like. Okay, maybe not as high quality as the stuff we put out today, so, but that's what they had back then, and John Philip Sousa himself helped enter the Marine Band into recording technology history.
Absolutely, and you know, we do record in beautiful halls like Carnegie Hall, Severance Hall, and in gyms and many different spaces, but one place that does stand out to me as a challenging place to record was in the NASA PACE.
This was where NASA was building the PACE satellite, and they had a sort of sound room that was this big industrial room with like 40-foot tall doors, and they would subject the satellite to a bunch of sound tests, and so we went and played in that.
Yes, it was a beautiful reverb chamber, very loud. We brought quite a few musicians in there, not our full ensemble, but it was hefty, to say the least. We did end up recording many different groups in there, but after all, that space was not ever meant for a musical recording. It was to test the capacity of which any sort of hardware that goes up to space can handle reverberation. So I believe we were the first musical ensemble or organization that has played in that space, and it was incredible. And it was a challenge to record in, absolutely.
I remember testing to see how many decibels we could get from the band, and I think we topped out somewhere around 130.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah,
it was dangerous.
Yes, and you know, for the listeners, we did wear hearing protection for that particular endeavor because that is a level of volume that no one should be around for a significant amount of time.
Something that I remember just my view of thinking, oh boy, how's the recording lab going to deal with this? We had a concert at the National Harbor once, and a boat was on the water, as boats are during the concert, and it was playing very, very, very loud, likely copyrighted music that I could hear it while I was playing, so I'm sure the microphones maybe picked up some of it. How do you deal with something like that?
Yeah, that's a tricky bit because, you know, again, when these concerts are happening, especially something like the concert you're mentioning, you know, the engineer that's on site for that particular event is primarily focused on, hey, we have a live sound event happening and, you know, making sure things coming out of the speakers are good, and you know, you check in on your recording to see how it's going, and you're like, oh man, Now I've got this background track happening. So we have some tools in post-production to try to help us remove some of these things. They're actually really great pieces of software that can help us, you know, analyze that particular recording and say, okay, I can see on this recording that there is some weird stuff in this one frequency range, and we can actually highlight that and attempt to remove it. And sometimes when we remove those things, we can scrub the recording of these artifacts. We deal with that a lot with coughs, with sneezes, candy wrappers. That's a big one. cell phones ringing during a concert. These are all things that we have to go into this software and analyze and try to get out what we can. The software can only go so far. So sadly, we can't remove all of them, but we try to get as much out as we can.
So just a last question before we go here, because I can't help but ask it. The Marine Band isn't always playing on at Carnegie Hall or in a or in the Severance Music Center or anything like that. You know, sometimes we're playing in a gymnasium on tour or outside, and there's an unexpected front of lots of rain. So what are some of the most unique challenges, Ophir and Mike, that you two have faced recording the Marine Band?
Well, you know, Ophir kind of alluded to this earlier. When we first walk into a venue, we're probably looking for things that no one else is. Okay, I hear the lights. Cool, that'll be something I'll have to deal with later. The HVAC is really loud in this room.
I've been on a few of those, yeah.
But, you know, as we alluded, we also play out in town, indoors, outdoors, when we're on tour. We're in a gym, as you said. All these rooms have their own challenge. Luckily enough, we do have a lot of tools to help us address some of those things in post-production that we can remove some of them. But, you know, when we're out at the Capitol, we're playing a beautiful live concert for all these folks. And, you know, the grasshoppers add a very unique soundtrack in addition to what we're recording that fine evening.
How was the cicada summer? We had a a 17-year brood come through a few years ago.
Yeah, it just adds some charm to that recording, because you know there's nothing you can do about it. But you know that was the night, and that's what we recorded. So yeah, some of the challenges, you know, we can't even list them because there's so many. And you know, the greatest thing is once we get the band set up and we deploy our microphones, we know that there's going to be a product from that night, and it's going to sound great. It's one of those things where some of the unexpected things that pop up, that's the beauty of live music and not studio-controlled music. And location recording, especially in the classical realm, it's one of those things where we're all about recording the details, and sometimes you get a little bit more than you bargained for.
Wow. Well, we all thank you so much for your expertise and appreciate it greatly. Mike, Ophir, Mark, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having
Thanks.
Us.
Thank you.
This episode was written by Staff Sergeant Connor Mikula, produced and edited by Staff Sergeant Joe Cradler. Recorded in John Philip Sousa Band Hall at Marine Barracks, Washington, D.C.